The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you to Andy Kahan at the Free Library for inviting me to speak. And thank you all for joining us tonight to talk with Professor Nahama Tech about her eye-opening book, Defiance, and the movie it inspired. For most Americans, Schindler's List is the canonical movie account of Jews during the Holocaust, a story not of the 6 million who died, but of the 1,000 or so who lived. It prompted one critic to quip, "Trust Steven Spielberg to make a Holocaust movie with a happy ending." As we now know from Nahama Tech's Defiance about the Bielski partisans who saved 1,200 Jews in Belarus, there is another Holocaust film with a positive outcome. As those of us who have seen the entire movie can attest, its picture of Nazi-killing Jews who do not perish in the death camps packs quite a wall of. In the film, it's very compelling how cameraman Eduardo Serra gives the film a kind of crystalline light that makes the Belarus woodlands an enchanting, threatening, and transforming place, just like a fairy tale. For the purposes of seeding our discussion this evening, it may be helpful to compare Schindler with Defiance in order to understand how Professor Nahama Tech has reframed and essentially rewritten the literature of the Holocaust. For me, Schindler is a story of redemption in which a Christian shepherd saves his flock of Jewish sheep. Defiance is a story of righteous survival in which Jewish shepherds fight to protect their flock and help them help others to save and protect Jews in the most massive rescue of Jews by Jews during World War II. Schindler conformed to one Holocaust narrative of helpless Jews at the mercy of Gentiles. Defiance is the narrative of active Jews who, although threatened to death, save themselves and others. To set the tone, and before we have a talk to Dr. Tech, let's begin with clip one from Defiance. It's going to take us a second or so for it to come up. Here it comes.
Our revenge. The poorest farmer has more than us.
Right.
What I am saying is we are not thieves or murderers. We may be hunted like animals, but we will not become animals. We have all chosen this. We live here free like human beings for as long as we can. Every day of freedom is like an act of faith. And if we should die, trying to live, then at least we die like human beings.
Dr. Tech, in your historical research into the Holocaust, you classified people into rescuers and rescued. How did the story of the Bielski partisans make you change your methodology?
I'm not sure it made me change the methodology because I see the Bielski brothers primarily as rescuers. They were both rescuers and fighters, but primarily rescuers. The most important thing for them was to rescue every Jew possible, and they did everything possible to do that. And eventually they started out as a group of 30 Jews. Most of them were related somehow and also friends, and gradually they grew into over 1,200 individuals. Most of them were women, older people and children, precisely those whom no partisan groups wanted to accept. So it was like a really miracle, both in terms of how many there were saved and who they were, because for a woman it was very difficult to be accepted into a partisan unit, or for a child, certainly not.
Tell us about your encounter with Tuvia Belsky in the interview that's the foundation of your book.
Bring the microphone near to your face.
Thank you.
To mine or to hers? Okay. My work, my research, has a great deal of continuity. When I start the project, it's invariably suggests to me some new questions to be explored, and very often these new questions become the basis for another project, and so this is how it goes. I'm very fortunate that I have this continuity in my work. So I learned about, I read here and there in some books mentioned the name Tuvia Belsky, so I knew, my ear was attuned to it. But then I heard about Tuvia Belsky when I was working on another book. I was finishing the book In the Lion's Den, and the main character, Oswald Rufeisen, was talking to me about the group of these Jewish partisans that he met in the forests, and how they were all arranging. They were living like in a shtetl with workshops and industry, and they were doing fantastic things. And so I listened to him, and as usual, in my research, I tried to check the stories. I tried to have as many sources as possible about the same event, so that if you can see it, I work in layers. So I decided I'm going to call this Tuvia Belsky and check whether really this is how his place looked and whether he really remembers Oswald Rufeisen coming and so forth. So I talked to him on the phone. He lived then in Brooklyn. And I asked him, I introduced myself, then I asked him, could he give me some information on Oswald Rufeisen? Was he visiting his forest and so forth? So he reconfirmed it. Yes, he did, and he did this and he did that. And, of course, I was taking notes. And then he says, why do you want to know? I said, well, I'm writing a book about him. Well, what is it that interests you about this Oswald Rufeisen? I said, well, he was a very unusual man. He saved everybody he could, both Jews and Poles and partisans. We don't even, and specifically, I said, I am very much interested in the fact that he arranged a ghetto breakout in Mir Ghetto, and he arranged it in a very complicated way, which would take me too much time to describe. But as a result of this ghetto breakout, about 305 Jews escaped and were saved, ran into the forest. He gave them arms. He arranged everything. So he said, 305? Big deal. I saved over 1,200. Why don't you leave his book, come to me, and write a book about me? I said, well, that's not how I operate. I'm sorry. But maybe I will write a book about you later on when I finish this one. In the meantime, I am just collecting data for this book. And if I explore it enough and think that it is important enough, I will come back to you. All right, he says, I would give you right away information if you come. So I said, well, I have to wait. And I sort of did what I said I was doing. I was finishing this book, but I was thinking about exploring further the history of Tuvia's partisan unit. And when I finished the book on Oswald Rufeisen, I called Tuvia, and usually his wife took the phone because he wasn't feeling so well, she said, and I asked her to give me some appointments to see him, to interview him. Well, I tried for a few years, actually, because I was already, I began to work on the book about this unit, but I have interviewed many people that were there. As when you read the book, you can see many people that were there together in the forest with them, but I never had a chance to get an interview with him. Either he was going to Florida for vacation, or he was not feeling well, but I couldn't get to him. Finally, one day I said, listen, my dear Mrs. Bielski, I must see him because I am writing the book. He wanted me to write the book, and I have to get a sense of him, too, from his perspective. And so she finally agreed to an appointment. The day came, I took a car. I live in Connecticut, so I took a driver with the car, and I went to Brooklyn, and it was in the morning, and I arrived, and Lilka opens. His wife's name was Lilka. He opens the door, and she says, I'm very sorry, but he cannot see you. I said, what? I almost fainted. I said, I'm sorry. She says, he had a very bad night. He's very sick, and it would be too much for him. He would get too upset. So I said to her, I promise you that I have to see him for 30 minutes, for 20 minutes, just to get a feeling, because I'm leaving tomorrow for Israel to collect more evidence for this book. And I have to get a feel of him myself. And as we argue back and forth, and she doesn't give in, I hear a voice from inside, let her in. Well, she had to let me in. And then I had the next step. I had to persuade her that I don't give interviews. How much time do I have for this?
Well, just talk a little bit about this interview.
Okay.
A little bit.
Okay. So I have to tell her that I'm sorry, I cannot have an interview while you are sitting there. I just have to have him, not you. So she, of course, he told her to go. So we closed the door, and he was whispering. He was very weak, and I was afraid that my tape recorder is not going to hear it. I hardly heard it. But so I'm writing, and I'm getting a little bit nervous. But as he starts talking, he becomes sort of, his voice becomes stronger and stronger. And like before my eyes, he becomes taller, and he was a very tall man, very imposing looking. And he becomes vigorous. And I feel that he took on the role of this charismatic leader that he was. And then the door opens, and Lilka's head comes in, and he looks very scared. She looks scared because she didn't know what happened. This was not how he was supposed to talk. And then she closes, and then this happens again. Time flies. We are 2 hours in, and I say to him, Tuvia, you know, we have to stop, and we will, you know, we can continue sometimes, but you, so he says, what's the matter with you? Are you tired? I'm not tired. Well, we stopped, and when we stopped, I told you, as we were saying goodbye, I said, well, when I am back, right when I come back, I will call you for another appointment. And then he said to me, I may not be here anymore.
And then what happened?
And then what happened? I went to Israel. 2 weeks later, I got the news reached me that he passed away. And this was 1987.
Okay. Give us a thumbnail description of Tuvia and his brothers. Where were they from, their social class? What did they do?
Oh, they belonged to a very small group, actually, of Jews, a small percentage in Poland, that we would define them as peasants, because they lived in a village, and they dealt with agriculture. You know, they were
farmers.
Farmers, and they had a little, what was it, where they make flowers and stuff.
Mills.
Thank you. I'm sorry, my husband isn't here. He always gives me the words. So they had very little education because they were extremely poor. And so the parents needed, it was a big family, 10 children and 10 sons and 2 daughters, and some of them had to emigrate to America to sort of make a living and stuff. And so Tuvia had 3 years of education, formal education, but he was very intelligent and very inquisitive, and he was self-taught. He knew languages, quite a number of languages, and well. Although we spoke, I always, when I interview, I ask the interviewee, what kind of language do you want, do you feel most at ease in? And Tuvia selected Yiddish. So our interview was in Yiddish. But I transcribe each of my interviews myself, no matter what the language. I never had it in Chinese, but we spoke Yiddish and stuff. Where was I? I lost.
Well, you described the brothers. So let's look at this. The second clip from the movie, and then I'll ask you more questions.
Okay.
Then we will go. And when a German spoke, his son, he said, I won't let that happen.
You won't let that happen.
No, I will bring him out myself.
Go to the ghetto.
Yes.
So, my little Moses, huh?
Looks good, I thought, you're wasting time.
I'm not the one who's wasting time, to you.
You're not the one questioning me in front of the others. We family, we have to sit together.
That's a scene between Liv Schreiber as Zeus Bielski and Daniel Craig as Tuvia. Now, in most accounts of World War II and films as far-flung as Casablanca and Pan's Labyrinth, the resistance leaders are the heroes. And in Defiance, you write that for many Jews in the resistance, the given was that waging war against the Nazis was more important than saving Jewish lives. How does the story of the Bielskis turn that given around?
Well, there were throughout the book, I present two kinds of partisans, Jewish partisans, when I talk about. There were those that were devoting themselves totally and completely to revenge, to avenge the death and the destruction of the Jewish people. So they wanted to fight no matter what. But there were those, like Tuvia Bielski, there were other groups like that, family groups, but they were not as successful and not as large, that devoted themselves primarily to saving lives. And at this interview that I had with him, I asked Tuvia Bielski, I asked him, what gave you these ideas? How did you come to this idea that it was so important to save lives? He said, well, very simple. He had a way of cutting through the most complicated ideas and simplifying them. He says, I watched the Germans. They killed Jews. They killed smart Jews and good Jews and bad Jews and crooks Jews. Should I imitate the Germans? They kill everybody without differentiating. They kill and I saved. I have my own way. And then he, right away, he said to me, I think that it is much more important to save one old Jew than to than to kill 20 Germans.
That was the most moving quote in your book for me. Actually, and another memorable line from your book is came from a Jew who fought with a Soviet detachment, and he observed, "The Bielski camp was for us what Israel is for Jews today. It was our life insurance." Now, although from the book of Joshua through the stories of the Maccabees and Bar Kokhba, Jews have been a warrior culture, but with the exception of the telefilm raid on Entebbe, I can't think of many examples in popular culture that celebrate unequivocally the Jewish warriors. And for instance, in this year's Academy Award nominations, Waltz with Bashir was very ambivalent about warrior Jews, as was Steven Spielberg's Munich not so long ago, but not so Defiance. There's a great scene in the movie where a Soviet officer encountering the armed Bielski brothers murmurs, "Jews don't fight," to which the Bielskis reply, "These Jews do." Now, what I want to know, if the ownership of guns was punishable by death by the Germans, how did the Bielskis arm themselves and their detachment, and how did they maintain their weapons?
Well, there were, as the Polish army was retreating during the war that they waged against the, where they defended themselves against the Germans, they dropped many of their guns and clothes and so forth. And the peasants, the Polish peasants or the Belarusian peasants, picked up those guns and they tried to save them, to keep them, because there was sort of an order from the Polish, it wasn't yet a fully developed underground, but by those that were in authority, to keep it and to hide it. So, and the Bielskis got their guns from, some of it they got from their friends. They were like peasants. They were like a part of the Belarusian and peasantry and Polish people around them. So some of them they got as gifts. Others they liquidated the, when they found, for instance, a small group of Germans, 2-3, they would attack them if they were, there were many more of them, and they would disarm them. So, and some of them they just got through this disarming others, and so that gradually, you know, in some encounters, they also would disarm the Germans and get some of the arms. So they, it was very, but you are very right, it was very difficult to get arms. However, they were so integrated into the peasant-like culture that they got it from many of them as gifts, really. As you will see, in, or maybe you won't see today, I don't know.
We couldn't get all the clips that we wanted, alas.
That's why I caught myself.
As a sociologist, how would you describe the organization of the Bielskio triad, and how do things work? You mentioned before it was like a shtetl, but give us a picture of the operations.
Well, when, you see, at first, the Bielski unit numbered only 30 people when it started. And then Tuvia was elected of the official leader of this group. And as a first order, when they were only 30 of them, he said that we are going to have an open-door policy, meaning any Jew that we can get or that comes to us, or that needs us, we are going to accept. So, where was I?
Well, describe how the encampment grew to look like a shtetl.
So, gradually they grew because they were accepting everybody, so obviously they grew. And they were moving from place to place for safety because they were afraid that maybe some spies are, you know, if they encountered some peasants, maybe they were spying on them, so they moved from place to place. Gradually, when they grew to about 400, it was very difficult to move with a group of that size. So he, at that point, this was like 43, the Russians have sent generals and prominent people into the area because they wanted to gain control over the partisan movement. And gradually they got more control, but never complete. So Tuvia Bielski went to the General Platon and asked permission to establish inside the jungle-like forest, to establish a shtetl-like, and that there they would have all kinds of industries. They would have a smithy, and they would make boots for the partisans. They would fix their shoes. They would do all kinds of things. So they became the official suppliers of the partisan movement. So this diminished somewhat the anti-Semitism which did exist among the Soviet partisans, and it made them useful citizens in a sense, and diminished the need for them, for the Bielski partisans, to go for miles and miles to collect some food, you know, because this was always a problem. So, for instance, if a Soviet partisan unit wanted to have some sausages, so they brought a cow to the Bielski shtetl that was built, and they got, let's say, 100 pounds of sausage. The rest, Tuvia's people, out of the skin, cow's skin, they made leather. Out of some of the meat they used for themselves, and so forth. So they really developed like a small industry that had everything. And also they had many doctors, the Bielski unit, so that the Russians, if they were really sick, there was a shortage of doctors in the forest. So they would come to the Bielski unit, and they would bring as a gift, let's say, a flower or potatoes and so forth for the services that they were rendering.
Exactly.
Okay.
From the inception of the Final Solution, the Nazis had targeted the Jewish elites, and those who were lucky enough to escape annihilation were ill-equipped for life in the forest. How did the Bielski detachment turn upside down received ideas about the social order with the intellectuals at the top and peasants at the bottom?
Well, because the skills of the peasants were so valued in the forest, you had to know how to milk a cow, you had to know how to ride a horse, you had to know how to be hungry, because you know. So that those that were hungry before, those that were without jobs, those that were peasants and worked on farms and so forth, their skills were much more useful. So they were at the top of the... It was an upside-down, in a sense, stratification. Those that were up went down. They were referred to as malbush, meaning the one that has just only the clothes on himself or herself, because their skills were not valuable. They did not adjust as well into the forest, and there were very few middle or upper class people in the forest itself, except for women, because the lower class partisan males wanted to have these women that were before the war upper class, because they looked up to them.
Was there anti-intellectualism in the encampment?
Very much so. Very much so. I don't know if you remember in the book when a common partisan that is a big shot talks to a professor's wife, and he says, "Oh, what language were you speaking?" So she says, "We're talking Hebrew." "Oh, do you know any other languages?" She says, "Yes, I know." And she tells him she knows French, she knows this. He says, "Can you make a soup out of it?"
How was upward mobility possible in the detachment? Were the people, were the Malbushim able to elevate themselves?
Well, yes. If a young woman came from an upper class background, she could really certainly got one of the commanders or one of the fighters, and then her situation would have been much better. And that really happened. The marriages or the connections between male and female created opportunities for the former upper class women to stay up, because they're, you carry within you sort of the social system, the class system, and you're used to it.
Were women treated as equals within the detachment, or what was their situation?
Not as much as you will see in the movie. No, much less. Women, unless they were able to find a young man that was attracted to them, but how many of us qualify? You know, how many of us are so attractive? So it was much more difficult for women in general. And now, we know that approximately in the entire partisan movement, the Soviet partisan movement, there were only 3% of women of all the partisans. So it was really a rare thing. But for some reason, for propaganda reasons, Stalin emphasized the part that the women were, how they were contributing, and what heroines they were, and so some of them were heroines, but usually it is only when it was to their advantage. Women could become fighters in situations that were very poor. In other words, where there was a need for any fighter and there was not enough, where the situation.
But did the women have guns? Did the women in the Bielsko triad have guns?
Advance?
Guns.
Oh, guns. Well, if you belong to somebody that was a fighter, then maybe he could arrange for you to have a gun. But otherwise, it was a rare thing that women had guns. Yeah.
Why don't we watch the third clip, please? As an aside, I just want anyone who has access to Bibi Netanyahu or Zipi Livni or whoever gets to form the coalition government in Israel, I think that Daniel Craig should become an honorary Israeli citizen on the basis of this movie in Munich. James Bond and his Israeli citizen. Okay.
I second the motion.
Oh, good. You write that in times of upheaval, those are who are removed from the mainstream of tradition are likely to see hope where there is none. To what extent did Tuvia's social position help him make the ideal leader for these desperate times?
Well, there was an absence of leadership. So there was a place for, and the traditional leaders, the prior elites, they just didn't fit into the situation. They didn't know how to act and how to behave. So there was a gap in leadership, and this usually happens in when there are upheavals, social upheavals. The people that are used to their skills don't fit, you know. So that is when, in times of upheavals, we know that charismatic leaders like Tuvia come up, and they are very flexible because they are not traditional leaders, so they learn as they go, and they have the charisma. And this is really a beautiful theoretical ideas that were developed by Max Weber, and which really show very clearly. And of course, I couldn't expect at Zwick to discuss Max Weber in the movie, but it fits into his theoretical notions as to the times when these charismatic leaders come about. And we had those charismatic leaders in different ghettos where undergrounds, and usually it was the younger generation, those that were not burdened with the traditional rules and traditional roles, you know, and they rose up and they became the leaders of the undergrounds. In most ghettos, there was a Jewish underground, but it was not the traditional leaders that were the heads of it, but the youngsters that were not yet, they were not imbued with the tradition, old traditions. They were not. They didn't interfere in their actions.
Thank you. I'd like to open up the questions to the audience. I'll ask you to wait for the microphone and speak into the microphone. We have this gentleman here with the glasses. You. Oh, right here. The microphone is coming.
I was thinking when you mentioned the fact that you tried to get an interview with Tuvia, and it was very difficult. And only 2 weeks before he actually died did he grant the interview. Then I was thinking back after the Second World War and the Holocaust that it was not spoken about. For a number of years, as I recall, people didn't talk about it too much. And then I read something about 10 years ago where a Holocaust survivor said something like this. Whenever I talk about what happened to me, I am there again. And I wondered why you had such difficulty getting the interview with Tuvia in the first place, and whether these considerations are a factor.
Well, the reactions of survivors vary when it comes to ability to talk. I am a survivor that did not talk about her experiences for 30 years. Nothing to do with any movies. I would never read any stuff about the war, wouldn't go to any movies that had to do with the war, never discussed it with anybody, not even with my parents, what happened when I was alone and stuff like this. Nothing. So there are some people, however, that could talk right away. That, fortunately, I'm very glad that I wish I had talked before. So it varies. Now, I don't think that my inability to get an interview with Tuvia Bielski had something to do with him not being willing to talk to me, because he obviously wanted very much. But it was his wife that felt maybe that it would be too strenuous for him, and he really was a very sick man. And she was protective of him, which I understood actually. But I was protective of my needs. So here we were.
You understood. This woman on the aisle here in the white sweater.
Hi. I will. I have to take off my glasses. Can you call? Yeah. I call from Stetl Vishnevo.
No,
but
this talking to the microphone.
Oh, I am from Stetl Vishnevo, not far from the Novogrudek, from these three brothers where they were in Aleboki.
Speak up, man.
I'm five kilometers just from this Pushche where they were in the forest.
What is the question?
Ma'am, question. Is there a question?
I had wind up two in the partisans. I worked 2 years in the labor camps in Lithuania. I wind up. And then I wind up in the Pushcha, Rudnitska Pushcha.
Rudnitska, yes, I know.
You know
yeah, I know, yes.
Rudnitska Pushcha.
Oh, yes.
I worked 4 months in Rudnitska Pushcha. And then they organized a group to escape. And while I were escaping, they asked me, "Wo lebst du?" So I said, "Leif mit mir." I were running, and I saved 10 people were running with me. When I came to the forest, I had 45 people running with me because they knew that I know my boyfriend organized the escape. And I came, and I had 45 people, and I took care of them in March for 3 weeks till they came in Pushcha Rudnitska. And then... I was the partisan. This is the partisan groups.
Okay.
I was 4 months in the partisans, and then they had an order from Moscow to get out from the Pushcha, and came and joined the Russian army, and I walked 6 kilometers to liberate the Vilna. And I got a trophy with the help of Mrs. What's her name?
Bergman.
Thank you so much for coming tonight, ma'am. This gentleman in the front row here.
When you, as we see in our own situation in the countries we're in now, when you have a successful partisan movement, you also have the people they're fighting, they're blind to certain things. And I wonder what things the Germans were blind to. Did they view all the Jews as basically passive? It was their problem that they didn't like fighting in forests? Did they think that all the peasants hated the Jews and would and always helped the Germans if they gave rewards, something like that? There must have been some blindness on the part of the Germans that helped these people survive in the forest, because obviously the Germans were trying to kill them, and they had a tremendous army and machinery and things like that. They had airplanes, for example, which were usually very dangerous.
What mistakes did the Germans make that enabled the Bielskis to survive? I mean, the Russian Soviet army came in, and that certainly was a help for the Bielskis. And what other factors?
Well, the Germans were constantly attacking the Soviet Union, and were constantly each time they attacked, they were sort of pulled. The weather really was so much against them. No sooner did they get some traction from their attacks, the cold weather set in, and they had to retreat. So it was already clear that to some of the army, German army, that in 42, that Hitler is not going to make it because he was too obsessed with the winning the war. War was really more important than anything else, but the generals didn't have You know, there was a lot of conflict between the German army and Hitler and stuff like this. It's a very complicated. The best analysis that was written is a 2-volume book by Kershaw about Hitler. It's a fantastic book.
Okay, the gentleman in the gray sweater.
Thank you. Could you speak a little bit about their relationship with the Polish peasants, whether they got things because they wanted to give them things or they had to buy it or take it by force?
Well, in Belorussia, in this area, there were most of the peasants were Belorussian, and most of them were very poor. And I discussed it in these 2.5 hours that I had with Tuvia, how he felt about, after all, they were taking food from people that were not particularly, they were themselves hungry, you know. And he said that this was really a problem, and they tried to find ways of how to diminish the pain on the part of the natives. And so, for example, all the natives, farmers, had to deliver some of their food to the Germans. And usually, let's say, if the delivery day was Thursday, the partisans knew it, and they knew the roads that they were taking. So they would attack a peasant that would come in a wagon filled with milk and eggs and meats and stuff like this, and they would confiscate the whole truck, but they would give the peasant half of it, and they would write on a piece of paper that the partisans attacked this peasant and they deprived him of all the food. So the peasant had half, and the Jews had half, and the Germans had nothing.
So they split the difference.
They split the difference. So you try to diminish it. You would go to the rich peasant in a village rather than the poor one that could not afford to give you anything.
Okay, can we have this gentleman right here?
Doctor, I want to thank you for being such a persistent person to go after the story to tell us all. My question is this. What kind of a job did you think they did in doing the film based on your story? And if you had your choice, would you have changed the movie in any way?
First of all, I don't want to compete with a brilliant director and brilliant screen writer like Edward Zwick. So I don't think I could do a better job. In fact, I'm very grateful that I had the opportunity. I was in Lithuania when they were shooting the film, and he gave me a chair right next to him at Zwick, and I was watching them work on it. And this is the first time, because, you know, I never saw anything like it, like to see Craig do a scene of 2.5 minutes 10 times over and over and over and over. I wouldn't have had the patience. So once I said to Ed, I said, but I see no difference between the one before. Why did you have him make another one? Well, he says, well, did you see the shadows on the windows and this? He had some reason, and he saw it. But what amazed me as a sociologist is, how do you put it together, these 10 times repetition and repetition, into one thing that comes out okay? So if anything, it made me more modest and forced me to think that I could never do that. It opened a new world for me.
This woman in the white sweater and the glasses in the middle of the sixth row.
This question relates a little bit to what the partisan lady went through, but in the book you talk about how people walked out of the ghetto or escaped from the ghetto and made their way over to the Otriad encampment. How many miles did they have to walk if they escaped from the ghetto to the Otriad encampment, and how did they know where to go?
Well, they didn't. Very often they didn't. I have one woman was a child, I remember, and she was walking and didn't, you know, couldn't back. What Tuvia did when they were more established, that there were special people that were going through the forest and they were searching for these lost souls and would bring them. And in fact, he brought this woman with the baby when she was already collapsing. Zush really found her, and so he brought her to the thing, and Tuvia was so happy to see her, he almost cried. You know, this strong man almost cried when a situation like this happened. But it was very, very difficult to find. Now, as to how many miles, it depends where they were, what ghetto. We are talking about a whole number of many, many different ghettos, and it depends where they were.
But as much as 50 miles, as much as 100 miles?
No, I don't think 100 miles. No.
Okay.
10 miles, 20 miles.
Okay. In the center of this row, yes, the one with her hand up. Mike is coming.
I'm interested in the fact of the similarity of Oskar Schindler and Tuvia in the years after the Holocaust. Both of them were charismatic leaders who did fantastic things during the time, and yet they both could not cope very well with the normality of life afterwards, and I wondered if you'd want to talk about that and how that applies probably to other charismatic leaders too.
Yes, you are right. You anticipated rightly that according to Max Weber, once the situation becomes stabilized, the charismatic leader that emerged in this time of crisis doesn't fit anymore. When you have, you know, the society gets settled, they don't fit, and they have to disappear, and they disappear. Yes, this is what happens, and that's what happened to Tuvia Bielski. But I, that's...
Okay, a young man in about the ninth row, in a greenish T-shirt, I think.
So, as an Orthodox Jew, I'm taught that the Jews are, you know, God's chosen people. How do you think that Tuvia and the other people in the encampment struggled with that notion in the midst of all the atrocities that were being committed?
The Jews are the chosen people? I think the Jews are the chosen people to suffer. That's what they are chosen for. Tuvia was not a religious man. Tuvia was not, he had a very open mind. You had in his camp people that were to the right and to the left of the political or the religious spectrum. He was not, I don't think he looked at it, he was influenced by religion. He liked the tradition, certain Jewish traditions, but he was not really a deeply religious or political man. Does it answer your question?
The hand raised over here, black jacket.
Good evening. I have a question. In Soviet and Russian literature and film, it was pretty much a taboo topic to discuss the anti-Semitism in the Red Army. But among the Jews, it was well known that in the partisan Otryads, the Jews were used pretty much as to hold off the Germans. They were often not given guns. So when you interviewed Tuvia, was it he who brought up the anti-Semitism among the Red Army, or was it you that asked him about it?
I don't think we discussed anti-Semitism per se in the among the partisans with him at this, you know, remember I had 2.5 hours with him. I don't think that this is what I was particularly interested in, but I have known, this was a known thing that there anti-Semitism in the Soviet partisans was rampant. It was very pervasive. And in fact, they were sending them on. And my book is filled with examples of anti-Semitism.
Person here with the beige sweater.
Thank you very much for tonight. If you had another chance to talk to him, what question did you not get to ask that you would have liked to have asked?
I haven't really thought about it much, you know, actually. I was really shaken when I heard that he died. But it wasn't a selfish sort of thing. Oh, I couldn't ask him this or I couldn't ask him that. No, because we really covered for the shortness of this, we covered a lot of ground, fantastic ground, I think.
What question would you like to ask him?
What would you like to ask him? Yeah, okay. That's a nice.
Okay, we have one more question here. Yes.
Thank you, too. Did you have an opportunity to interview the other brothers, the other two that survived from the forest? And if so, what did you talk about with them?
I interviewed Zush. Asael, of course, was dead, so I couldn't interview him. And I interviewed many, many people that were there, so... What do you mean? What did I talk? You want me to tell what the content of the interview was? I mean, I did interview them, yes, but I did not get as much from Zush as I got. He was not as smart at all, and not as capable as his brother. That's the truth.
We have one more question. This gentleman right here.
Have you had to deal with any Holocaust deniers and or people who criticize you for possibly commercializing or romanticizing the Holocaust?
I don't deal with Holocaust deniers. I would never give them the satisfaction. I would not ever discuss anything with deniers.
The other part of the question was...
The other part of the question is, have you had any criticism with respect to commercializing or romanticizing what's happened in the Holocaust?
I never had this. And in fact, all my work concentrates on the interdependence and the relationship between the positive aspects such as rescue, resistance, compassion, mutual help. There's those rare features of the Holocaust which were rare and overshadowed by the enormity of German crimes, but nevertheless they were there and they were very, very important, because in times of difficulty these positive things in times of crisis are very important, because they improve the quality of life. If you think about your personal life, when do your children need you most? When they have problems, when they are sick, when they are uncomfortable, then mother can do something, you know. It is in times of great difficulties, we have a great need for the appearance of these positive features, and they improve the quality of life. That's what all my work is about, the interdependence, the connections between these rare features of extreme situations.
On that note, I'd like to thank Dr. Teff. And Dr. Teck will be upstairs on the first floor to sign copies of her books. And I hope you meet her there. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.